You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, August 9th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, today, August 9th, we will have on the program Chris Hayes. Coming off the recent announcement of his weekend television program on MSNBC to start, I guess we'll ask him. He'll be talking to us about various sundry things like, what the hell is going on? And what's going to happen with this debt commission, et cetera, et cetera. But ladies and gentlemen, I would be remiss if I did not mention that today, August 9th, 2011, 6 years ago to the day, at 2 a.m. in the morning, 2:15, my daughter, Myla, was born. And ever since, my life has been completely ruined. But aside from that, I am very proud of her. And, of course, I love her very much, despite the fact that she ruined my life. And in celebration of her birthday, as you know, we named her after the Majority Report. Her name is Myla Ray, we named her after the Majority Report. Long-time listeners will know that. And sadly, now that she's 6 years old, she has decided to adopt certain likes and dislikes, and one of her likes is Justin Bieber. This morning, I gave her a Justin Bieber T-shirt for her birthday. When I left, she was still making out with the T-shirt. And so, in honor of my daughter's birthday today, Myla, this goes out to you.
Oh,
all right, folks, we're going to take a break. I'll leave you with this. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Chris Hayes. Later in the program, the Wisconsin recall race is happening today. I'll tell you why it's going to be so close. Al Franken attacks. We'll be right back with Chris Hayes. We are back, ladies and gentlemen. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Is there another program in the entire universe where you would juxtapose Justin Bieber with the, of course, the other teen heartthrob, Chris Hayes?
That's very kind of you.
Yes, of course. I have no doubt that by her 7th birthday, my daughter will be begging me for a T-shirt with your picture on it, and she will be spending that morning making out with that T-shirt like she was this morning. It was perhaps one of the most disturbing moments of fatherhood that I've had to this point. I'm sure it'll get worse. Chris Hayes, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me on. Good to be here.
All right. First off, I would be remiss if I did not congratulate you on your soon to be launched show on MSNBC. Just briefly fill us in here.
So we're going to have a weekend morning show. It's 7 to 9 Saturday morning and 8 to 10 on Sunday. And it's going to be, we're sort of putting it together now, but I envision something that kind of, is a look at what's going on with the benefit of a little bit of time perspective to synthesize and kind of exercise some discernment that the daily grind of the news cycle makes extremely difficult, right? To kind of go a little deeper on things, to explain things, to put things in context, which some of the primetime shows, most of the primetime shows do very well, but we're going to have the advantage of having a week to meditate on the meaning of Anthony Weiner's crotch shot. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah, of course.
We don't want to take a first cut at crotch shot analysis. It's going to be, we're going to go deep on crotch shots. We're going to do history of crotch shots. I mean, that's our niche.
And of course, it's a weekend show, so it'll all be animated.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. We're going to have, what's that thing with the animated part of Saturday Night Live? The
TV Funhouse? Are they still doing that?
Yeah, exactly. A TV Funhouse every weekend on whatever the sex scandal du jour was.
Fantastic. And this is launching in the fall, in September.
Yeah, in about a month, mid-September.
Fantastic.
That might be, that's a little, I wouldn't put that quite in stone, but but right before it launches, how about I come back on to try to...
Fantastic.
And I'm hoping the great Sam Cedar will also be a guest.
I will be in touch with my people, and we'll see what you can do. I do, actually, I do a one-man show all on crotch shots, so I've got that in my back pocket right now. All right, so and I know you've you managed to go on vacation at the beginning of the month, and good for you. I think you missed the big announcement or the big debt deal. But give me your sense of where you think this is going. I mean, obviously, let me put it this way. By December, the end of December, will you be talking about how they have finally managed to cut Social Security and Medicare?
Well, I don't think. Well, let me say this. Clearly, it's like the line about why do you rob banks? That's where the money is, right? I mean, one of the weird things is that we're having. First of all, we have a very dysfunctional and bizarre conversation about debt and deficit for a whole host of reasons. But one of the host of reasons is if you're going to say, well, what's the thing that constitutes the bulk of the budget? And you know this very well, and you've talked about it at length, and your listeners, I'm sure, do. But, right, it's obviously the large social insurance programs, a term I prefer vastly to entitlement. Entitlement is such a weird word, right? Like, it makes you think of, like, people in first class, like, ordering fancy wine, which I think is the point.
You know,
entitlement. Like, you are so entitled with your $600 a month Social Security check. Look at you. Like,
you know, I'll tell you something. I think, after hearing Tim Weiss last year, I think it was, at Netroots Nation, talk about how welfare became so problematic for the right wing, essentially when black people started getting it. When I hear entitlements now, I get this sense of just sort of like, yes, that there is an uppity quality if you think that you deserve this in some way.
Yep.
And yeah, I have a real problem with that term as well. Social insurance is in fact very accurate, and we've all paid into it when we talk about Medicaid, right. Medicare, and Social Security.
Yeah, it's social insurance. I mean, it's a way that we manage society-wide risk, right? It's a way that we pool risk together socially to smooth out the sharp, jagged edges of chance, contingency, and volatility, right? Because some people lose an arm in an accident, or they get very sick very young and they can't work, or
we don't know at age 22 that we're going to have enough money to retire.
Right.
I mean, that's basically
But the weird thing about this whole deficit conversation is that that's where all the money is, and everyone knows that, right? I mean, that is most of what the government does is in these large social insurance programs. After that, the next big thing it does is defense, and then after that, domestic discretionary funding, right?
Right.
So it's in order of where the money is, it's 1, 2, 3. Now, what happens is one, even though they want the Republicans hate it ideologically and want to kill it. It also is incredibly popular among their core demographic constituency, which is older white people. Okay,
right.
Older white people like their Social Security and like their Medicare and like their Medicaid if they're in nursing home treatment, right? And for good reason. They should. It's a good program, right?
It 60% of Americans get over 50% of their income in retirement from Social Security.
Right. Exactly. So there's this tension within the Republican, you know, within the conservative coalition, which is that government, get your government hands off my Medicare tension, which we're all sort of familiar with at this point. So there's a lot of talk about what we're going to do to those entitlements, and it's why Democratic buy-in is so key, because Republicans have to go back to their own constituents and be like, oh, we're screwing you, but we're all screwing you, right? That's why it's all got to be sort of done collectively. Then there's defense, which is also incredibly sort of sacrosanct and amazingly embedded in the military-industrial complex. So that doesn't generally get touched, although this deal actually made some headway in that way. And then there's the stuff that's the smallest amount, which always gets the most cuts, right? Which is like, you know, heating assistance for poor people, national parks, highway funding, all that other stuff.
Right.
So it's a bizarre, like, sort of ass backwards, like the politics and the rhetoric all line up to produce this bizarre way of going about dealing with what are in the long term, genuine long term structural deficit problems born of an aging population and increased healthcare costs. That is the core problem, and yet that is never addressed.
and everybody
wants to get self-righteous about how brave they're being. And no one actually – the only people that have actually addressed that long-term core problem are some of the very brilliant minds who worked in the weeds of the Affordable Care Act on reforming the delivery system, which is the most boring technical thing in the universe, but the actual key to long-term fiscal sustainability.
And this bizarreness is sort of overlaid on the bizarreness of actually having this conversation at a time like now.
Right. I mean, that's the other thing that's so crazy, right? And this is actually something where actually you're seeing something bizarre and fascinating play out in this, which is that the degree to which there's this disconnect between the actual economy, which is facing a possible double-digit recession, is desperately in need of additional stimulative demand from someone somewhere, for the love of God, please, which is what the markets are now saying, which is what Wall
right.
Street is now
right.
saying.
Right.
And it's a fascinating thing. You have this situation. I was emailing with a friend of mine who works at a hedge fund, and he said the disconnect here is so bizarre. Wall Street, everyone on Wall Street is like, this is crazy. We are in serious danger of going back over the precipice, and all Washington is talking about is cutting. And it's gotten to the point where even the plutocrats recognize how mad it is, which is saying something, because there's a certain kind of wing of the sort of Wall Street capital-intensive plutocratic establishment that wants austerity. But they're now realizing something, and I have a Nation column coming out this week, that as much as they thought they could get away with a situation in which corporate profits were good and returns to banks and the financial sector were good while the rest of the economy was in the crapper, they're now realizing that's not sustainable. It turns out American consumers and working people can't be neck deep in debt and no jobs and power profits for the rest of corporate America. So now,
see, that paradox to me is the most fascinating aspect of this story, because, you know, 3 months ago or 4 months ago, whenever it was, maybe it was in March, when PIMCO came out and shorted treasuries. When PIMCO shorted treasuries. This was back in March, I guess it was. And I was on Radigan's show, and David Stockman came in, and he was literally saying, this is the end of America in like 4 months. I mean, to the point where I was like, this guy needs medication. But he was saying that the idea that PIMCO would short treasuries, and what has become clear over the past month or two is that PIMCO made a really bad bet. They actually bet that the U.S. government would do what it needs to do in terms of creating stimulus, which would probably put some upward pressure on treasuries, increase the interest rates, and they would make money on that slight margin of increase. And they have been shocked. I mean, you have the head of PIMCO, Mohammed Albarda, going out and saying, like, this is ridiculous, like begging the U.S. government to do what everybody anticipated they needed to be done, and they didn't, and so they've lost, presumably lost some money. They've gotten out of that position more or less. It was a horrible bet, and they were betting on the sensibility of the government, and it never happened. And so I don't understand, like, where is this push to austerity actually coming from if at least some of these players, the plutocrats, as you mentioned, are sort of aware that this is going to kill the economy?
Well, I mean, there's a very well-funded austerity kind of austerity industry in Washington. I mean, the Pete Peterson Foundation. And then, you know, that is married to a long ideological strain that's hated the welfare state since its sort of present instantiation, the Liberty League, which was a group of, say, you know, businessmen and CEOs who opposed FDR and wanted to kill Social Security then, and, you know, right through Ronald Reagan recording LPs that were played at coffee klatches in the 1960s to oppose Medicare from the American Medical Association. There's longstanding deep ideological opposition to the social welfare state, and people see crisis as an opportunity to kind of deal a death blow to it. But what it's running, there are times when, and they're not often, but there are times when the ideological right and the sort of self-interested practical concerns of Wall Street actually come into tension, right? So the TARP vote was a classic example of that, right? And the debt ceiling and debt default was another one, right? I mean, there were a lot of people in the Tea Party, I came to believe, who genuinely not just were willing to tolerate default, but genuinely wanted it, right? And there was no one on Wall Street of whom that could be said. I mean, maybe people that had made a bet that it would happen, but aside from that, I mean, no one really wanted to see that happen. So you're reaching this point in which the ideological agenda on the right is so extreme, it's actually remarkably coming up against the genuine sort of practical survival instincts of the wealthy people and sort of wealthy industries that run the country. And usually you bet on the latter. I mean, it's a weird thing because it's a little like the Iran-Iraq war. I mean, it's kind of tough to figure out like who exactly you're rooting for. But but like it's, you know, you get to a point where, you know, the ideological considerations run up against these practical ones. And I thought the whole way the debt ceiling thing played out was a perfect example of that. And my money is always on Wall Street, right? I mean, my money is always on the forces of sort of power and money in the country. But I was shocked at how close a call it was, to be totally honest.
But wasn't that because that essentially the Obama administration, instead of aligning themselves with and leveraging that impetus from Wall Street, sort of aligned themselves with the ideologues who wanted to cut the social insurance programs.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I think that one of the things that's going to be very interesting is how that alignment and coalition plays out in the Republican primary, right? Because, you know, the establishment does not want a maniac at the helm. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, it's very hard for me to think, like, you know, the hedge funders and you know, CEOs of Fortune 500 companies and the people at the Chamber and Financial Services Roundtable are, like, psyched about a Michelle Bachmann presidency because – precisely for this exact reason, right? Precisely because there are these points in which, you know, they want – they are small c conservative in the sort of classic sense, right? They want to conserve the power they have. And you know, people like Bachmann and those are genuine sort of reactionaries, and they want upheaval.
Well, this is like – it's so, like the immigration is sort of like where –
exactly.
Where
that's
the,
another place where you see it. Yeah.
Where the sort of the electoral Frankenstein that they created got out of control. And but I get, like, why, where, how do you explain Obama, the Obama administration sort of aligning with those ideologues? Because I'm quite convinced that there will be a deal from the super Congress or super committee, and it will involve cutting Medicare and Social Security, and they will figure out a way of doing it. My guess is it's going to be repatriating corporate taxes so that Democrats can walk out with revenue and Republicans can say, we never raise taxes. In fact, we cut taxes. I mean, but that seems to be the goal. I mean, that seems to be the goal from a Democratic administration.
Well, I mean, look, the goal, I can't quite figure out what their goal is. I mean, I think in the short term, the obvious goal is get reelected, and the obvious way to get reelected are – there's two ways you can look at reelection, right? You can say the way to get reelected is to produce a genuine recovery.
Right.
Okay. But, you know, it's unclear whether they can do that, right? I mean, in fact, it's quite clear they can't at this point. I mean – they cannot. They'll maybe some unemployment insurance they can get through. Maybe a payroll tax cut extension, which are significant. You know, they're not to be scoffed at. I mean, that's genuine, real, important money for real people who are really suffering and out of work, particularly unemployment insurance. But the Republicans aren't idiots. I mean, obviously they understand that they have to. They're not going to go along, both for ideological and practical reasons, with anything that's going to be, like, you know, vastly stimulative. So there's no real fiscal measures in the arsenal right now. So if that's not the way that re-election is going to happen, then the way re-election is going to happen is through the brand of the president, Barack Obama. And this is one thing I can tell you that they are fixated on inside the political operation of the White House. They are fixated on the fact that there is a significant gap, wedge, between the president's job approval ratings and personal approval ratings, which is to say the president has about 10 points higher personal approval than job approval. And they think that's essentially the key, given the fact that they cannot produce a real robust recovery in the next 18 months. They think that's the key to his reelection. Now, purely from the political perspective, I'm not sure they're wrong. I mean, I think that's about as good a thing to hang their hat on as anything, right? Like, it is true that the president is very popular as a person, as a figure. People trust him. They think he's reasonable. They think all these sort of good things about him generally, even if people are like, you know, the country's on the wrong track. I hate Congress more than anything in the universe. I mean, Congress is the least trusted institution in the country. And I don't think he's doing a good job managing the economy. I still think he's a good guy. And I still think he's a good guy is basically what they have right now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the reelection strategy. And so then you start thinking about what are the things that reinforce, I think he's a good guy, and their decisions make a lot more sense, right? Because in a time when people hate partisanship and the sniping, et cetera, you know, the one reasonable guy in the room, the guy who listens, like, they think this is a huge part of what makes him appealing and why people like him, and they want to bolster that. Now, there's all sorts of political reasons to say that's not true, and people want, you know, someone who's stronger and fighter and draw sharper distinctions, and I'm sort of agnostic on the question because I actually don't feel like I have a great political sense of these things. But the
but
fact
it's not
is,
an irrational, it's not an unreasonable, political choice. I guess
no, because people talk about it. You know, even this Drew Westen piece that was in the Times Sunday Review,
right,
and everyone's talking about. And, you know, look, yes, should the stimulus have been bigger? Yes, but, you know, forget everything that has happened, right? Sam, get David Plus job tomorrow, right?
Right, exactly.
And the question is, what do you do, from here on out.
When do you think that happened? I mean, when do you think that moment happened where they said, where the administration said, like, oh boy, whatever's gone on up to this point, we're not going to, was it basically after the 2010 election? Whatever's gone on at this point, it's baked into the cake. And now, so we're just going to deal with the cards that we've been dealt. Was sort of like, putting it in the passive so they don't have to feel bad about what the decisions they made in the past, rather than saying the cards that we actually dealt.
Yes, right. That's right. That's exactly right. I think it was after the election. I think they think they got a very good deal in the, you know, in the tax cut extension because they were able to get to sort of smuggle in all this stuff, right? You know, the UI, mm-hmm. the extension they got and a lot of money more. You know, if you look at it purely Keynesian, right, they got a lot of essentially deficit spending, as it were, in the form of extending the tax cuts. Again, like I'm not agreeing with that. So the point is that if you're helming the Obama White House at this point, you're his chief political advisor, and you know that this Republican Congress is going to, over their dead body, will you be able to do anything? I mean, they're threatening to actually actively destroy the economy, right? They're certainly not going to do anything to repair it, right? So everyone understands, yes, the way to get reelected is to have unemployment dropping rapidly and have growth increasing and have people's personal disposable income going up and personal bankruptcies going down. Like, everyone gets that. We've all seen the political science models. But if you can't do that, okay, and you're running the White House and you can't do that, it's like, what do you do? I mean, it's not an enviable spot politically, right? And you can say it's a spot of their own making, and I'm sympathetic to a lot of the arguments that say it is a spot of their own making. Again, you're hired today, and you're looking forward. And I think the path forward they think is by saying basically it's going to be I'm the reasonable person who you can kind of trust versus some either flip-flopper or crazy person.
Right.
And that's what the election is going to come down to. And so then everything becomes oriented around how do you sort of sustain the brand of the reasonable person you can trust. And the policy epiphenomenal emanations of that – are, you know, bipartisan committees and compromise and balance and all the tropes that we're now – that are so kind of like maddening and dreary, I find, right? Because you want to say, no, that's not going to help.
And he gets his cake and eat it too at this point when he comes out and supports Leon Panetta's argument that we can't cut defense. We need to cut entitlements or social insurance. Because he, at the end of the day, it's Congress. It's
right.
Not me. It's Congress.
That's right. And he's going to, you know, and I think there's going to be an opportunity also for them to run against Congress, which right now they don't seem to be doing. But, you know, I am, you know, I think like everyone, I mean, part of what's so frustrating of this is my last point and then I have to run. But
right.
Part of what's so frustrating about this is that, you know, Marchman had this good piece, a decent piece in The Prospect about being like, you know, defending the current structure of Medicare can't be a progressive priority. And at one level, he's right in the sense that the sort of fee-for-service model of Medicare and the way that it's structured from the payment perspective has to change, right? And so it's frustrating because you could have a genuinely progressive conversation about what that looks like, right, which could be called entitlement reform. But what's so frustrating is that you and I both recognize that we're not really the voices that anyone's listening to or those people are listening to when that super committee gets put together. And so what you end up having to do is just say, like, no cuts, no cuts, no cuts,
right,
which isn't really the position, right? Because we understand that, like, Medicare as currently constituted in its payment structure is not, you know, the absolute final utopian stage of it, right? But – you cannot trust that the progressive voices are going to win out once you acknowledge, yes, let's talk about how to cut. Because once you acknowledge, yes, let's talk about how to cut, the people that are empowered are the people that want to do really regressive things like raise the eligibility age.
That's right. They use that as leverage to essentially destroy the program.
Right, right. So if you can think of getting 12 people around a table who were progressives committed to social insurance – who did not want to destroy the program, who could come up with a bunch of ways to make it more sustainable fiscally out into the future, particularly on the Medicare end, right? But that's not where we're going to get. So then the dilemma is, well, then how do you deal with it politically? And the way you deal with it politically is you hammer people for suggesting cuts.
Exactly. All right. Well, Chris Hayes, I know you got to run. I appreciate you taking the time. And we are all looking forward to your program and to talking to you again soon. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Dan, and I'll have you on soon.
Great. All right. Chris Hayes, ladies and gentlemen, we got to take a break. Got to go work on the cupcakes that I am making for Milo's birthday tonight. Just got to go. I've got three or four more to frost, which I will do during this next break. When we come back, we will talk Wisconsin. We will talk Franken. We will talk, actually, just one note. I noted that the Obama administration, or the political operation, already laying the groundwork, showing they're a little bit nervous about Mitt Romney, consistent with what Hayes was saying in terms of them. It's all about re-election right now for the Obama administration. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are back. So there you have it. I mean, I think it's a fairly good explanation of where we're at right now in terms of the Obama administration, a combination of either just incompetence or a right-wing perspective. Right-wing may be a little strong, center-right perspective on the economy has led us to a place where they greatly underestimated what needed to be done, or maybe greatly underestimated is the wrong word. Maybe they just perceive the world to emanate from the banks. And so when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. When you're a guy of that world, that becomes your solution. And at one point they realize, not going to work. Probably said, not our fault. And now, how do I win a re-election? What is the easiest path? And for them, they perceive it as walking all over the middle class and the poor, essentially. And frankly, understand who gets tread upon here, too, from an electoral standpoint. Put aside the fact that we're going to be screwed out of 10, 15, 20% of Medicare or Social Security. Put aside the fact that access for poor people on Medicaid, perhaps even Medicare, will be curtailed. Put that aside. Put the policy implications aside. Understand what also happens is that this is going to be very difficult for Democrats running in Congress. The Senate probably is already gone. You have 22 Democratic senators running, 11 Republican senators running. That may actually even be different now because we have a couple of retirements on the Democratic side that were unexpected. There is still a slight chance the Democrats could take Congress. I don't know what they're going to do. And this is why I keep asking that question, which Democratic congressperson is going to run against Obama? It's going to say, you need me there to protect further cuts to Social Security or Medicare. And not just from the right-wing crazies, but also for the Obama administration. President Obama, just yesterday, in response, or not direct response, but I guess ignoring a letter from Barney Frank asking President Obama to essentially distance himself or repudiate Leon Panetta, the Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta came out last week, said that in order to deal defense spending should not be on the table, that it's more important to cut social insurance or entitlements. And so Barney Frank sent President Obama a letter and said, it's time for you to tell Panetta to shut up publicly, because that's not what you want. And turns out, well, Obama yesterday in his speech at the White House, I guess it happened around 1:30. We were off air by that point. Said, quote, our challenge is the need to tackle our deficits over the long term. Last week, we reached an historic agreement. I may need to play some more Justin Bieber. Reached an agreement that will make historic cuts to defense and domestic spending. But there's not much further that we can cut in either of those categories. In other words, we don't have room in the domestic discretionary budget, and we don't have room to cut any defense. You know, it takes a lot of money, folks, to maintain an empire of 750 garrisons and forts and bases around the world. What we need to do now is combine those spending cuts with two additional steps. Tax reform that will ask those who can afford it to pay their fair share revenue. We won't get that except for the corporate repatriation. You know, I'm harping on this so much. I'm overdoing it slightly. I'm going out on a limb here, but I'm just convinced. I don't know what it is. John Smith showed up at the end of my bed last night, floating 3 feet above me, and said, there's actually a third book, not just the Bible, not just the Book of Mormon. There's also one. This is the one about the tax repatriation. And then I couldn't sleep for the rest of the night. Tax reform will ask those who can pay for it and modest adjustments to health care programs like Medicare. So there you have it. Meanwhile, Eric Cantor, even realizing that the lack of revenue is part of the S&P downgrade, tells his Tea Partiers, do not cave. We don't know who's going to be on the Cat Food Commission 2. The Super Congress, we don't know yet. The real question is, who are the senators going to be on there? I'm sorry. I just don't think it. I think it's going to be at least one who is willing to make a deal with the Republicans on this. I think this thing is already baked in the cake. I think everything you're going to see from now until then is simply posturing and pretending, and that's it. Sorry. Onward and upward. Today in Wisconsin, the recall of 6 Republican state legislators is taking place. Polls still have it extremely close. It's quite possible Democrats could only win one of these 6 races. They need to win at least 3 to shift the balance in the state Senate. There are still 2 Democrats that are up for recall. Unlikely that they will lose, but that will take place next week. And the reason why it's so close, Chris Bowers weighs in on Daily Kos. John Kerry lost 5 of these districts. There are 6 districts. In 2004, John Kerry lost 5 of these districts significantly. In 13% and 15%. This is a very, these are very Republican districts. Obama, who won Wisconsin by 14%, only won one of these districts by more than 4%. So he barely eked it out. There was a huge amount of turnout. So if the Democrats are able to take 3 in these races, it's going to be by a razor-thin margin. In the entire history of the United States, he points out, only 13 state legislators have ever been recalled nationwide. There's an attempt to recall 6 of them in one day. There have been literally millions of dollars poured into these districts. Can you imagine? More money probably than even maybe perhaps even the national elections. Can you imagine what $1 million, and there have been millions, what $1 million buys you in a semi-rural district in Wisconsin in terms of media. I mean, it's beyond comprehension. So we've posted on the blog, yes, links to links where you can actually make some phone calls. It will be helpful, folks. They're an hour behind us. It's only 11 in the morning in Wisconsin right now. Call. Get some people out to vote. It's going to be a get-out-the-vote win if it wins.
They have until 8 p.m., so that's what, 9 p.m. Eastern?
That's right, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. they can vote. And if you're in line, my understanding is by 8 p.m., you can vote. Finally, Al Franken, you remember, I guess it was a week or so ago, 2 weeks ago, we played this audio.
Yeah.
Franken sitting on the judiciary questioning the testimony of a guy named Tom Minery, who is from Focus on the Family. These are the people who hate gays professionally. And, you know, the Focus on the Family was Dobson. I don't know if Dobson's still there, but he's the one who said, you know, take your small child into the shower with you. Show him your penis so that he understands who's boss. That was, I got to tell you, one of the most warm and loving situations with my daughter when I followed the Dobson prescriptions. No, I think actually he suggests doing that only with your son. But be that as it may, Minery claimed that a U.S. Department of Health and Human Services report showed that children living with their own married, biological, or adoptive mothers and fathers were generally healthier and happier. The argument being that if a kid lives with two gay parents, forget about it. The kid comes out twisted. And so Franken basically said, I've read that report. It doesn't say that. It just says that if they're with two parents, and the report includes gay parents, not parents of opposite sex, also same-sex parents. And Minery was like, he didn't even do that. He just sat there. And Franken was, Franken's very understated, a little bit dry with his stuff. So leave it to public radio. Carrie Dacklin. And this is written by Frankel Haraldsson. Is that a really real name? I don't know Carrie Dacklin of Minnesota Public Radio wrote on July 29th that Franken missed an opportunity to be kind to a witness. Dacklin wrote, "I have testified at trial. It's not fun. It's not exciting. It's stressful. You're out of your element. Now, I have no knowledge of congressional hearings, but I only hope that if I did testify before the Senate, whoever was questioning me would be kind, would recognize that it was his sandbox, not mine, and that as a representative of our country, he would not embarrass me for his own purposes." Sadly, when Tom Minery testified, that was not the kind of treatment he received from Al Franken. So, this guy, Clacklin, or this woman, Clacklin, I don't know, Carrie Dacklin from Minnesota Public Radio, never mentioned that. Oh, incidentally, the guy was lying. It was rude of Franken to say, hey, how come you're testifying that a report includes something and it doesn't? Dacklin concludes, "A fine performance, Senator Franken. But here's the rub. In case you missed it in those DOMA hearings, the Defense of Marriage Act hearings, the federal government doesn't recognize same-sex marriage. So I would think it might have been reasonable for Minery to assume that a federal report had followed federal law." And I guess what Cacklin is saying here, it was rude of you to set him straight and in some way undercut the ability of our society discriminate against gays. Tisk, tisk. It's not what America wants.
It's kind of like, you know, you tackle someone to the floor, and they, like, kick you off of them, and they're like, whoa, whoa, why are you being so rude? Whoa, calm down, man. Why are you getting so violent?
Right, exactly. The point is here is not where you fall on DOMA or gay marriage. The point is that Franken sadly did exactly what we as a nation are finding so frustrating in government today. He polarized the situation. He escalated it. That's not an appropriate role for the powerful position he occupies. What the frick are you talking about? So, folks, understand that when you call someone on a lie, what you're doing is you're polarizing the situation. What you should do is say, thank you for lying. May I have another? This is why I never listen to public radio anymore, because they're nuts. All right, folks, that's our program for today. Tune in tomorrow. Find out what happens with Wisconsin. And more. You can join me in the post show by IMing me at Majority FM. And folks, please, if you have the opportunity, if you have the money, please become a member of the Majority Report at majority.fm. I need your memberships. It will keep this program alive, thriving. You can also support the show by buying your junk on Amazon. I'm not happy with the company, but if you buy stuff on Amazon, buy it through our link. It supports the program. I guess you got to pick your battles. And one thing I can say without any hesitation, buy your coffee, tea, and chocolate through justcoffee.coop. Use the coupon code 10%, majority, save yourself 10%. This is such a great deal all around. If I made more money from it, it would be the only thing I talk about in the show. I would do literally an entire show just about it. But we do get a couple of shekels, we get some coffee from them, and so and frankly, it's a great company. So I'm happy that we can throw some business their way and make it worthwhile for us. So join us in the post show, ladies and gentlemen, where I will take your IMs and, in fact, your phone calls. If I can get my computer keeps freezing on me.
How many tabs do you have open?
5,000.
There we go.
Is that a problem? All right, folks. We'll be right back after this.